You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 100.5 FM.
This week, the British Guardian newspaper carried a report from Gaza by reporter Chris McGreal, and in it he had this quote: Mohammed Al-Qudri was staring at the rubble of a house where two young children and their father died on Tuesday. I've really tried to understand the Israelis. I used to work on a farm in Israel. I speak Hebrew. I watch their news. All the time they talk about fear, how they have to run to their bunkers to hide from the rockets, how their children can't sleep because of the sirens. This is not a good way for them to live, said Qudri, who now scrapes a living growing his own produce. We Palestinians don't talk about fear. We talk about death. Our rockets scare them. Their rockets kill us. We have no bomb shelters. We have no sirens. We have nowhere we can take our children and keep them safe. They are scared. We are dying. On the phone from Chicago, discuss Israel's murderous attack on the people of Gaza is Ali Abu Nima, author and co-founder of Electronic Intifada. Welcome back to Vancouver Cooperative Radio, Ali.
Thank you, Mordecai.
There are a variety of speculations about the reasons for Israel's latest bombing of Gaza. What do you think they were doing it for?
Well, first I want to just really underline those words that you read, because I think they really do sum up the imbalance in the situation. And I use that word advisedly, because so much of the media coverage has been quote-unquote balanced, suggesting there is somehow some symmetry at best between Israelis and Palestinians, if not presenting, you know, Palestinians as the aggressors and Israelis as the victims. And I think those words from a father who lost his own children really bring the reality back into focus. You know, Israeli leaders talked about restoring deterrence as a reason for this attack. And that's a very strange choice of words, because, you know, again, one of the underreported things is that this Israeli attack started on November 14th when Israel broke a tenuous ceasefire that was in place. And that has really been the pattern every single time. There's been a lot of speculation that this is related to the Israeli election. I'm not really so sure about that. Israel never really needed an excuse for this kind of outrage. And Israeli leaders know that these adventures, these massacres, can be risky from a political perspective. I think that this is really just the periodic bloodletting that Israel feels it has to carry out to tell Palestinians their place, to tell people in Gaza that their fate is to be caged into a giant, what is effectively a giant open air prison, and not to have any hopes or dreams that this situation will ever end, that they will ever see their rights restored, or that they will ever, heaven forbid, be allowed to go back home, since 80% of them are refugees. So that's what I think Israelis actually mean by restoring deterrence.
Now, after 8 days of this massacre, the Israeli government and the elected government of Hamas in Gaza both signed an agreement. I think it's important to let people know what exactly that document specified.
It's a very short document, and it is you could call it a ceasefire agreement, in which Israel agrees to end its attacks on Gaza by land, sea, and air, and those attacks have been relentless and constant, even though the media report the reverse, which is, you know, they claim constant Palestinian rocket attacks on Israel. So number one, that Israel will end attacks on Gaza by land, sea, and air, that Israel will ease its blockade on Gaza, although it doesn't specify exactly how it will do that. That remains to be seen. And in return, Palestinians will cease rocket fire on Israel and cross-border military attacks. And it says that Egypt will be the party that will monitor the implementation of the agreement. What's interesting about this agreement, too, is that in Israel and in elsewhere around the world, certainly among Palestinians, it was seen as at best a draw from Israel's perspective, or even an Israeli defeat, because Israel attacked Gaza, eight relentless days of bombing, more than 1,500 airstrikes, more than 160 people killed, of whom 103 at least were civilians and 37 children. And at the end of that, Israel was not able to stop rocket fire, not able to break the resistance, not able to impose its will, except by negotiations with Hamas. And of course, you know the refrain as well as I do from the Israelis, that we don't negotiate with terrorists, we don't negotiate with Hamas. Well, the reality is that Hamas is the only Palestinian partner that Israel ever negotiates with.
So then it's easy to understand why Hamas would sign such an agreement. Why did the Israelis concede?
I think that they had no choice. You know, they were facing the military reality that they could not stop retaliatory rocket fire, and I think that's really what it is, because usually rockets are fired in response to Israeli attacks. Again, the reality is the reverse of what mainstream media reports. So they could not stop rocket fire by military means. In fact, since their last major assault on Gaza in 2008-2009, what we've seen, what we learned this time, is that Palestinians in Gaza have developed their military capabilities to the point where now these rockets, which only used to be able to get 2 or 3 kilometers outside of Gaza, can now reach Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, a range of something like 70 or 80 kilometers. So that's number one. There's no military solution from Israel's perspective. And number two, Israel faced the choice of escalating even further with a ground invasion. But I think Israeli leaders must have calculated that a ground invasion would, again, not change things militarily, but would be incredibly costly politically for Israel in terms of its already difficult international situation, and possibly in terms of loss of lives of soldiers at the hands of Palestinian resistance.
The Egyptian government played an important role in this, and that speaks about some of the changes that are happening in the Arab world as a whole, from North Africa into the east of the Mediterranean. Have the correlation of forces really significantly modified in terms of Israel's capacity in relation to the Palestinians and the Arab world as a whole?
That's an open question. It may be that given the regional situation, Israel felt the cost of the ground invasion might politically be even higher than otherwise. It's clear there wasn't any international support for it, and even Israel's so-called friends were advising against the ground invasion, and that must have weighed on Israeli leaders to some extent. As far as Egypt is concerned, you know, there's a lot of debate about how different Egypt's role is. Certainly, President Morsi emerged with some additional credit for having been seen to broker the ceasefire, but other people are saying, well, you know, he was really the front person for the United States in this, and so Egypt's role is still a little changed from how it was under Mubarak. I think that remains to be seen. But what's true is up until that point, there had been little practical change in Egyptian policy, particularly with respect to the effectively maintaining the siege on Gaza and continuing to constrict the border crossing into Egypt and Rafah.
I'd like to go back to the comment you started with in terms of media and its framing constantly of the conflict as one between two equal sides, the reference to it as a war as opposed to a massacre. Did you notice any change that's significant in the U.S., Canadian, or European reporting of this Israeli bombardment of Gaza compared with the way it was framed in 2008-2009?
I certainly didn't notice any positive change, I'm sad to say. And Amina Salim, who's written some amazing analyses of the BBC coverage for the Electronic Intifada, did another one in the past week or so, really forensically documenting the outrageous biases and false framing from the BBC, which of course is so influential globally. So I, if anything, I think it's gotten worse. It certainly hasn't gotten better. As always with these things, there are a few bright spots, and certainly that piece from Chris McGreal that you quoted at the beginning would be an example of that. But I think what also has become more of a factor, and we published this morning a piece by Rana Bakir, a student in Gaza who's been blogging for the Electronic Intifada for some time, and she did some incredible things over the past week as this was going on. One of the things that was very simple but nobody had really thought to do before was to just record audio of the relentless sound of the drones and the bombing and the shelling. And that audio really went viral around the world and was picked up by many mainstream media organizations. So her piece, reflecting on how citizen journalists such as herself were able to have such a big impact on coverage, is really well worth reading.
I noticed here in Canada that partway through the Israeli bombardment, they finally did send a reporter into Gaza, and it was noticeable, to me at least, that the very presence of him in the midst of the bombardment in Gaza, I would say if it didn't alter the content, it altered the tone, at least, of the report. The realities of the Gazan people began to come far more to the fore than they had had previously. I don't know if that was a phenomenon of other reporters in other media and other countries being in Gaza this time as they weren't in 2008-2009, at least as I remember, having some impact on what the listeners were obtaining from the media.
Well, I'm honest, I'm glad to hear that, if that's true. And I think there were more reporters there this time. But so often it's not the reporters who are there that are the ones who frame the story. It is the editors, you know, back at HQ, who impose this false balance. And as Rana Bakir wrote today in the piece I mentioned moments ago, you know, how can the reporting be balanced when the reality is so unbalanced? And that's what that powerful quote you started with captured, is that you have the CBC, the BBC, the New York Times, etc., trying to present, you know, quote-unquote, both sides as if they're equal, as if they're equally affected. And this fake balance, as I call it, really imposes a false narrative where, you know, you'd almost think two equal powers were at war with each other when the reality is an occupied, besieged, and largely defenseless civilian population that is 80% refugees are being bombarded by a world superpower with the full support of governments like the Canadian and U.S. governments and others. That's not a balanced reality, so the reporting should reflect it. And reporting that is accurate will always be criticized as being pro-Palestinian, because some of the critics want to see reporting that presents Israel as a victim, which of course is spinning the truth, to say the least.
Some of the statements from Israeli cabinet ministers and other political figures like Ariel Sharon's son, who was making reference to Hiroshima and Nagasaki as alternatives to be considered, an Israeli cabinet minister who spoke of driving the people of Gaza back into the Middle Ages, others who in the cabinet who referred to a Holocaust as a positive reference for what should be done to the Palestinian people in Gaza. These were comments that certainly didn't appear with much appropriate prominence in the media here in Canada. I don't know if they got much prominence elsewhere.
I think that's such an important point, and I was very with assistance from some of our Hebrew speaking readers in the U.S. Documenting these comments in the Hebrew media, and of course the contrast is that the spokespersons that Israel was putting up to the CBC and BBC etc. were always talking about this is a limited thing and we're doing our best to avoid civilian casualties, and that's what they were saying to the media in English. But back home in Hebrew, we're not talking about fringe figures, we're talking about cabinet ministers like the Interior Minister Eli Yishai, a very powerful figure. We're talking about major prominent members of the Israeli parliament were going out there making these outrageous comments, calling for mass killing, for Gaza to be flattened, for it, to be flattened like Hiroshima and so on. And these comments were not being reported in our media and not being used to counter the false narrative that, Israel just wants peace and Israel, is a law-abiding country that is concerned about the fate of Palestinian civilians. I think our journalists need to be a little bit more curious and a little bit more willing to present Israel as it presents itself.
And our listeners and others who want more information need to turn off CNN and tune in to Electronic Intifada.
Yes, absolutely. Well, one of the great things is that our traffic went up tenfold in the past 2 weeks, and that allowed us to convey the reporting from people like Rami Al-Mighari, our reporter in Gaza, Rana Bekir and others who were witnessing it on the ground, experiencing it themselves, and really giving some amazing coverage with, unfiltered by editors back in Atlanta or Toronto or wherever else who are so careful about politicizing the coverage by introducing this fake balance.
Well, thank you very much, Ali, for speaking with us this morning. We appreciate it, and we certainly appreciate Electronic Intifada.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
My guest has been Ali Abunima, author and co-founder of Electronic Intifada.